And then obviously, you know, we went to the final itself, and a great occasion, a great week. And I always remember in those days, you know, a lot of the Gloucester players were local players, and quite often they'd go back after we trained, you go back to your own local club, or you go back and train up there, because Gloucester train on a Monday and a Thursday, and a lot of the local clubs train on a Monday and a Wednesday. And that week, I remember it's bringing you right back down to earth. I went back to Gloucester Old Boys, it was in Orton Road, and it was on the Wednesday. And I didn't train, I just went up afterwards and just had a drink with a few of the boys, and everybody sat around the table and just talking about the cup final on the Saturday at Twickenham, etc. And I was sat there and we were all talking away, and one of the boys just turned around to me and said, "Viv, are you going up Saturday?" And to a man, I think there must have been six or seven of us sat around his table, just fell over with laughter, because this kid didn't even realise that I was playing. And then what a way to be brought back down to earth. And
yeah,
and we went up on a Friday night. I remember going up, we stayed in the Richmond Hill Hotel where the England players used to stay. And the story I always talk about, in the morning we'd had breakfast, and there was obviously big lawns there, and we all stood out on the lawn looking over, and you could see Twickenham from Richmond Hill Hotel from the lawns, and you thought, well, you could throw a stone into here from here. Anyway, we got on the bus and we started driving. We were driving, and somebody suddenly turned around and said, "Drive, why are all the supporters going one way and we're going the other way?" And he said, "I don't know where we're going," and he got lost. And it was a story, and just made us all laugh and cry. And just probably took a bit of tension out of the travel, really. And I was sat next to John Watkins, and Gilly said something to me, and I said, "Yeah," I said, "same jeans, Gil." And he said, "I'm the same, Viv." He wore the same shirt, the same trousers every game in the cup rounds. And that those little superstitions sort of crept in.
There was something about the logo that you wore for the final. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, we obviously got to the ground, and you carried your own bags then, and all the baggage, and you took all the shirts in, and luckily we had new shirts given us, and we walked out onto the pitch, just had a view of it, and you warmed up in the change rooms, the same sort of thing. You were quite enamoured because of the bars or whatever. But luckily, Gloucester played Harlequins in the semi-final. So we knew what the change rooms were like. And Harlequins often played at Twickenham prior, or was it after Christmas, because of the Vasta game. So their home ground not only was a Stoop, but also Twickenham. So we had quite an affinity with Twickenham. We knew what was to be expected. And we put our shirts on, and it was literally 5 minutes before the kickoff. Somebody from the BBC, I don't know whether it was Nigel Starmer-Smith or not, come in and said, "Look, you're going to have to change your kit, because the logo that you've got on your shirt is a form of advertising, and the BBC will not." And we had to cover the logo over with some tape, I think, if I remember rightly. But that soon disappeared as soon as the television people walked out of the room. And we were about to go out. It was the knock came on the door, sort of 2 minutes knock by the referee, and everybody's looking around the room, and there was two or three players missing, and they were being sick in the toilets with just nerves.
Really?
And and one of them was Pete Butler, believe it or not, who amazed me, because he had a wealth of experience, obviously. But the occasion had got to a few of us where people were very nervous. But luckily, we went on and won the game, thanks to Moggy. But I just remember it being a very, very physical game, and fair play to Leicester. You know, they really turned up on the day. Because I remember a few months previous, we'd beaten them at King's Home by 30-odd points. And earlier in the season, we'd beaten them away as well up at Welford Road. So I think subconsciously, we were all thinking this is going to be not easy, but it's going to be a game that we should win and should win well. But obviously, fair play to Leicester and every one of them. Stuck to their task, and it was a very, very physical game. It wasn't that free-flowing. I don't think Leicester could afford it to be, not with the likes of Moggy and Bob Clues out on the wings, because both of them had the ability just to score tries out of absolutely nothing, especially Bob Clues, who in my opinion was once again another underrated player as far as the international scene was made up to be.
Yeah, he scored the key try in the Harlequins game, didn't he?
He did, yes. I remember we had a move on the front peel, and they used to come off John Fiddler in the middle, and John Watkins used to go around the front, and Steve Mills at the time, or Fred Reed, would take the opposition hooker in, and a bit of obstruction, and nine times out of ten we'd score, and Gilly for some reason saw the line, and I was screaming and shouting at him to pass me the ball, but he didn't, and he didn't get to the line, sadly. So I owe him one for that. It's not passing me the ball, because I think that would have been my fourth try in four games. But the tries dried up then, especially in the cup final. But it wasn't free flowing. It was very, very physical.
You talked about the move, which obviously led to that try. Who was doing the coaching, and who sort of set the scene for some of those moves? Because there was no formal coach in post, was there, in those days?
No, there wasn't. No, it was Mike Nichols was our man in charge, and a lovely gentleman named Ivor Oakes, who used to run you up and down the steps and backwards and forwards and carrying people, and everybody always had to carry somebody a lot heavier, and I always ended up with Fiddler or Boyle, and it used to break my back. They've never bought me a point for it ever since. But any little moves or anything were just made up amongst ourselves, really. Luckily, people like John Watkins, who'd had a lot of experience at England level, and Mickey Burton at international level as well, and come up with one or two moves. But no, your motivation, John Watkins was skipper then, believed that motivation should come within, and he wasn't a stamper of the table and jumping up and down where Mike Nichols was. And I remember one game at King's Own vividly, where Mike had got into such a frenzy in the changing room, stood at the end of the table, he was banging the table, and you didn't want to look up just in case he picked on you. And I accidentally looked up, and Mike was actually frothing from the mouth. And I think every one of us to a man was just glad to get out onto the arena rather than put up with Mike in the changing room. But was a great servant for Gloucester Rugby Club, and obviously he's sadly missed by all the players that had any dealings with him. But John Watkins, a different skipper, totally different, very quiet, very unassuming, just got on with his job and expected everybody else to do theirs. But he led from the front. If there was a breakdown, usually Gilly was the first there.
Well, then Bob Clues and Steve Mills were captains again in your later tier.
Yeah, both of them very different skippers, especially Millsy. At times I felt sorry for Steve because he had his head in the scrum most of the time, so a lot of the decisions that were going on he couldn't make. But he was a good skipper, and so was Bob. A little bit out on the wing, really. But the skipper that stands out is obviously going to be John Watkins and Mickey Burton from the year previous. I think Jim Gilly went on as skipper the side for three seasons. But Steve was a very, very good hooker. And to keep Fred Reed out of the side, who in my opinion was as good and nearly better than Steve Mills, to keep him out of the side, you had to be pretty special. And Bob Clues is Bob Clues. He always reminded me of Alan Morley, the Bristol winger.
Was probably the problem, wasn't it?
Yeah, it could well have been. They just had the...
Too similar.
Yeah, two similar type players, both with great gravity of balance and thunder thighs. And people used to tackle them and used to bounce off them. and they did. They just had this low gravity that was tremendous, and just used to get over the gain line really.
But Gloucester changed, didn't they, when Bob Cruise became captain? Quite a bit. I mean, the coaching changed at the start. In came Keith Richardson.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Keith. For a first time for a long time, Gloucester were captained by a back.
Yeah.
Coached with a very different sort of attitude towards the game, perhaps.
I think the previous to Bob, it could well have been Don Rutherford or even Buffer Bayliss. Was the last skippers maybe? I can't really remember.
And the winger would probably be right back to John Taylor.
It would have been very much so. And Keith came in, the coaching and the training regime completely changed. There was a lot of the training you did then. You actually saw a ball. in the previous years, you didn't see much of the ball, but. Probably that's an over-exaggeration, but Keith changed it. He brought his educational background into the skill setup, and things did change. And it was then, I got injured against Pontypool, and I missed a fair bit of a season, and I ruptured my ligaments and my cruciate. That is sort of second rate nowadays, isn't it? Yeah, everybody's doing it now when you're reading the reports. But I remember working extremely hard and actually playing a game. And it was 14 weeks after the operation. And Lennox was the surgeon that did it in those days. And I played my next game up at Northampton. And there was myself, John Watkins, and John Haynes in the back row. And that was my first game back, but it was never the same. And then some which gave the other players an opportunity to put their hands up, and then we had the likes of Mike Teague started playing properly and training and becoming the number eight that we all know he was. And obviously John Gadd, Mike Longstaff, Paul Wood, those sort of Elka players that were starting to sort of change the scene as far as rugby was concerned, alongside people like Keith Richardson and Don Rutherford. Don Rutherford had shown his Elk. He was part of the RFU then. I think he might have been technical advisor or something like that. I think Mike Teague has got a lot to thank Keith Richardson for. Just the way he changed the game as far as Gloucester was concerned. Because it helped Mike Teague, who was, when he came here, I always remember him being quite tall but very skinny. He was probably about 11 stone dripping wet, I think. And we used to do a thing called the 600 metres, and it was sort of near enough twice round the pitch. And it was in the early days, and Mike used to win it hands down. He used to beat everybody. And he used to even beat Richard Mogg, that takes some doing.
Andy Ripley about him.
Yes, he certainly did those days, and then he changed. He started doing his weights, and he became far greater and a great personality within the game as well. Very quiet, but a tremendous, but absolutely tremendous player, and just part of that family, wasn't it? It was part of that King's Own family. Some of the Teagues had played before. There was a lot of Teagues locally playing. And